Welcome to another edition of the Exponential Podcast. I'm Todd Wilson, Director of Exponential. We're thrilled you're taking advantage of this free resource that was recorded at the Exponential Conference. It's part of a library of hundreds of hours of free training. In our mission to equip church planting leaders, we seek to distribute as many free resources as possible. Visit exponential.org to learn more and to check out the programming for the upcoming Exponential Conference.
What was it in your background, in what you saw, what you heard, because it was so counterintuitive, especially at the time?
Well, I'm old. I'm 70. So I was born right at the end of the war. And in 1950, I went to the Portland, Oregon Foursquare Church, the biggest church in Oregon. And we were into all the 50s kind of gimmicks. You know, we had the governor come speak. We'd have movie stars that just got saved come speak. We had Sunday school contests. We had, you know, whoever brought the most people won prizes. And then I went to a Bible college, and they taught me things like, never for any reason ask anybody to leave your church. Well, 1 Corinthians differs with that. You know? So I had been in a dorky thing. I mean, I tend to tell long stories, right? But I had been in a Bible quiz, a national Bible quiz, and we actually won it. But I had memorized the Gospel of Matthew in my senior year of high school. So I have this is way before the hippie deal gets started, but this sense of if things aren't right, you oppose them. First day of high school, homeroom teacher writes on the blackboard, question authority. And I thought she was a communist. It was just like, you're weird. But I bought in. And then in my second year of the Bible college, this idiot professor went off. And he'd been kind of messing around with girls a little bit. And we went to the administration, and they did nothing. And so now there's all these things inside of me. Yeah. And I, in a youthful 19-year-old childish fit of anger, decided to read the book of Acts every day for the rest of my second year of college. So I'm getting inculcated in all these things. Then the Jesus movement hits. A guy took me to Costa Mesa, showed me Calvary Chapel with sliding glass doors on the side because people sit outside and look in and all that. Well, a few months later, I'm pastoring a little church, and 2 weeks before I started out, I hear Chuck Smith talk. And he tells about, he did away with the Sunday night evangelistic service in those days, the show. And every Sunday night, he does 2 hours of Bible study, 10 chapters a week. So I tried. I got to where I could do a chapter a week. But we start to have this foundation under us of Bible, just through the Bible. And it actually started questioning my own thoughts when I hit Romans. Because I went to a kind of a Wesleyan approach, Pentecostal college. And, you know, there's all the security in Romans. And it's like, you know, am I wrong here? And then, like I told you earlier, one of our guys got kind of drafted to do a Sunday night service at some people's house. And that went on for about 2 months. And he and I were Dawson Trotman fans. And so we were in Palos Verdes where Dawson Trotman got started. And we'd walk the perimeter of a golf course every Monday morning at 6 o'clock and just talk. He, 2 months in, the group decided they wanted him to be a pastor. And we're at level two, which I just taught this stuff in Japan last week to a level three church.
Okay.
And they're, by Japanese standards, they're big at 220 people. And they're about to throw off another service, and it'll fill. I mean, they're full to the brim. The guy, his problem is more, he has the values down. But he doesn't really trust anybody. So he hasn't really done the disciple making that's necessary. But anyway, Rich and I would meet and pray and just talk about these things. Well, 2 months in, they decided that he should be their pastor and they should be a church. And I told them no. We were part of a denomination. They had a one church, one town rule. We would violate that. He never went to Bible college. I was pastoring the first few weeks. There was hippies, bikers, and a topless dancer. That was my congregation, besides my family and close friends. And we started with 12 people. Everything they say you shouldn't do, we did. Our own money, ran out of money in about 6 weeks. It was just a God thing that it even survived. you know, they wanted to call it a derivative of our name, and that seemed like we were trying to start a kingdom. I didn't want to do that. But about 6 weeks later, the Navigators recruited him to go overseas. And I'd always been taught that you need to be a pastor successfully before you can be a missionary. So I kind of decided, well, let's just do it. And so we did it. Went to a denomination, and I strung the guy along for 5 minutes going, well, I might have done something wrong. Didn't really have, you know, I'm sorry. And he kept begging me, what did you do? And finally I told him, and he was all for it. And then Rich decided he didn't want to join the denomination. But they went ahead and started 5 more churches. So we actually went from level 2 to what I would call level 4 a week ago. And I was in church calling it level 4. And I came home and I started realizing, but those guys went out and started 4 more churches almost immediately. So we were actually, but I wasn't a participant. We had jumped to multiplication, but I was still thinking reproduction. And so I stayed there for probably 10 more years. And it was a thing, a God thing. I actually saw a vision. It's a very weird story. But I moved to Hawaii because I saw a vision, and I thought it was nutty. And I came home, and a guy described it to me. And 19 days later. And so we went to Hawaii with a vision to start enough churches to reach 1% of the state in a decade. It actually took us 11 years. But at that point, we were thinking multiplication because we knew we couldn't do it by ourselves. And so the paradigm shift happened about 10 years after we began reproducing. I was the 30th guy to leave a church that I started to go plant a church. And so, but all along, we were thinking level 4. We weren't thinking level 5. Along the way, when we started out in the Jesus movement, everything was Bible studies. Everybody wanted to do Bible studies. The problem was that, you know, the plumber has to come home from work, prepare. You get in the middle of the thing. He's halfway through his outline, and some woman starts crying. And he's going to ask somebody to take her outside and counsel her, or can you hold that till the meeting's over or something. And so we knew that wasn't right, so we're looking for something. And then the other thing is the Bible studies, the Jesus movement actually had a, in 1975, 76, it just abruptly came to an end. I remember the day that we were a church, we'd bought a building, an old bowling alley, and we grew from 400 to 800 in a week. And we were hurting pretty bad because people didn't know each other. We're a hippie church. There are several Jaguars and a Rolls Royce in the parking lot. And some of our guys started wearing suits to church, and we just kind of lost our identity. My wife and another woman started a women's ministry, which was anathema. I mean, we were hippies. I'd changed by that time. And you don't do things like softball and women's things. You just do Bible studies and worship for an hour and preach for an hour on Sunday, and that's the whole story. And I remember I was so angry that they started this women's thing that I was sitting in the parking lot and tears came to my eyes. And it hit me. This thing is over. You got to go back to working at building the church. Then we begin to realize the Bible studies are drying up. They were all spontaneous, and they're just not happening anymore. We never trained anybody for anything. It just happened. So we made 3 different attempts at what ended up being called mini church. And one of our daughter churches in Hawaii had started doing small groups. We were calling them small groups at the time. And they'd meet on Sunday nights. We'd come to church for worship, and then we'd break up into homes. And it wasn't working very well. Well, these guys canned their Sunday night and just met in homes. So that one got a hold of us, and we did it with Wednesday night service. And we were at that point, we'd shrunk down to about 600 people on Sundays from 800. Wednesday night, we'd have about 85, maybe 80 people. The first week we did mini church, which was highly contrived at that time. These days it's a lot. It's a lot simpler. It's not loose, but it's simpler in its approach. We'd write discussion questions off the sermon. Somebody told us if you hear two life-changing messages in 7 days, the second cancels the first. So we thought, well, let's just build on the sermon. And so we got seven large houses in Southern California, and we're at the beach, rich neighborhood, mm-hmm. Big houses. We had 365 people show up in seven houses, and it was horrible. And the following week, we had 12 groups. The week after that, there were 20 groups. And so we were off to the races. It took a little while. We modified it to where basically we come together and eat. Some just, bring poo-poos, the wine were for snacks. Uh-huh. In our situation, my wife cooks dinner. And then we just hang out and talk about what did we pray about last week. How's it going?
Tell me a little bit more about how that started. I mean, we launched this Bible studies. I mean, how did you talk to your people the first week where you had 365?
We had a guy named John M. Sutz. Peter Wagner was coming to our church. And he hooked us up with a guy, actually in our own denomination, named John M. Sutz. And he did a teaching for us because we knew we were in trouble. We're this crowd. We used to be a church. Now we're a crowd because we moved uptown. We're on the Artesian Pacific Coast Highway. Anybody in L.A. County knows that location. Overlooking the ocean, it was, and there's still this hippie church with all these middle-class people coming in. And so we were just really, really confused. And so Amsets did this thing on church growth. It was called 8 Characteristics of a Healthy Church. I still have the notes. And the thing that he hit on that struck oil was a healthy small group ministry. This was a Saturday at noon. And in those days, we were hippies. We just did things differently. 4 o'clock Sunday afternoon, we had a meeting of every leader we could imagine, including the rebels, including a six-year-old girl that never went anywhere without two girls following her. We brought everybody together, about half our church. And we presented this idea of we'll kill the Wednesday night deal. We'll gather together around the sermon. Sunday night, we'll get leaders together, the leaders of the groups, and we'll come up with discussion questions. And they went for it. And so, 10 days later, we did the first one. And then it took a while. I think we might have actually been in Hawaii by the time we morphed into basically all we ask is, what did the Holy Spirit say to you while the pastor was preaching? Because it might be something different than what the pastor said. B, what are you going to do with it? And then C, how can we pray with you? And we try to keep the prayer time away from prayer requests where you're praying for Aunt Jenny's cousin's cat and where you're just praying about whatever you talked about during the meeting. Mm-hmm. It may have been during the time we're eating dinner and you talked about you got in a wreck that week or, whatever. But it's very, very simple, very much purposeful. But then the other component is that each leader ideally will have two apprentices. And we call them pastors. And we actually, as much as we can, get them to in Hawaii, it's very easy to license a guy to do weddings.
Okay.
And so we want them to do weddings, funerals, mm-hmm. All the pastoral gig kind of things, Mm-hmm. And so
these are just the leaders themselves that you call pastors, or
yeah,
is
the
that
leaders
kind of
the
approach
church.
You did to all people that
no, the leaders there. We call
okay.
pastors.
Okay.
And so we're trying to build this just DNA into them that this could possibly lead to you planting a church, not that it necessarily will, but that you're a candidate, and that you should have at least two apprentices. And if you're getting ready to leave, because that's the way we start new ones, you hive off, you're going to take, say there's four people, number one, two, three, four. Number one is going to take number four with him in terms of strength and leave the group with number two and three so that we've built security into that relationship. And the guy with the most experience is going out the door, and number four immediately becomes number two. And so there's an expectation always put on everybody that you're going to move up the chain in terms of leadership. And then it's very random from there. It's in our situation, talking to Todd this morning was really good. in the discussion about the needing to break from number four, level four to level five, because we kind of see, in a way, we avoid strategic thinking in terms of church planting. It's really more we're promoting a value and vision. So we're looking for a guy to come to us and say, God's called me to this community or this country. And then we'll go, well, what do you need? And we'll try to send as many people as we can. We fund everybody differently. We ask them for their first month's budget. And we'll, if the guy has been on staff in our church, we'll include his salary. If he's bivocational, then his salary isn't part of it. But our model, when everything's working right, is to fund the entire 6 months, first month's budget. And then we taper it by 10% per month. At the end of 6 months, fly or die. And our churches tend to teach people to tithe, and they tend to give pretty well because they know they have to. And we've kind of given them leverage in that, hey, these guys are going to cut the money off in 4.5 months now. We got to start doing something.
Yeah.
And it's paid off. So
it's interesting about what we call mini church that some people might refer to as small groups. In fact, yeah. that strategy came out of a small group strategy. Yet so many small groups and churches tend to be inward focused, right. not very robust, and they certainly don't grow. Where did the growth come from? Was there a mission orientation?
There's a mission orientation. We talk about it. We talk about these things continually. We've built the church around Ephesians 4, that we're here to equip you rather than to entertain you or to even bless you. We're here to equip you. And then Acts 2, which is the cell church model. And we just modified that. And so we talk about that constantly. We have a different person from a different mini church every Sunday take the offering. And so if they want to get up there and talk about tithing or something, that's fine. We really just want a testimony from their life, but everybody knows that they're from a mini church. So not necessarily a mini church leader, but they'll end up talking about their mini church. So we just do what we can to make the whole idea of mini church permeate everything we're doing. Mm-hmm. The missing link for a lot of people, I think, is this, that our church is small enough right now. It's about 300 people. So I'm running personally three different mini church pastors groups, and we're going through In Search of Excellence by Tom Peters right now.
Okay.
We'll do Wind in the House of Islam by David Garrison next, and then The One Thing by Neil Cole, to just give you a kind of feel for what we do. But the guys who don't come, just don't come. They're a good example of what happens when you don't do ongoing training. And so we just let that go. I mean, we're still kind of hippies at heart. And I'm probably working with about 25 people in those three groups. Some of them are wannabe mini church pastors who are, you know, apprentices in the situation. Some of our guys are just too busy with work, and we understand that. Some of them just don't want to come, and we just let that go. So we're entirely dependent on the Spirit of the Lord motivating some guy to want to go out and do something, and then we've got resources that we can bring to bear on it.
But it seems, too, that somehow you've worked into the DNA that this is an expectation.
Oh, yes.
Yeah,
it's definitely an expectation.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily, there's no pressure of we're demanding you to do this. There's an expectation that the cream is going to rise.
Yeah.
And it just happens, and so it leaves us without. I mean, the kind of criterion that we depend on the most is, are people following you? If you don't have followers, no matter how much schooling you have, you're not a leader. And so our biggest rub in all this is the guy who went to seminary, who comes to us and wants to go plant a church. And inevitably, our answer, and usually they leave us, they go someplace else. But sometimes they'll stick with us. The answer is always get a job, locate in the community, join a mini church. If the guy sees leadership potential in you because of the way you handle yourself in mini church, he'll pick you up as an apprentice. And then when he leaves, he'll leave it with you. And then now you can start coming to the training meetings. Well, I don't need the training. I've been to seminary. I keep telling you. I go, so I'm going to put you in line in front of the guy who's a carpenter, who's been doing this for 6 years and is expecting to go out and plant a church, and you're cutting in the line in front of him. That won't work with us. Like I said, most of those people don't stay with us. And that's probably our loss. You know, I recognize that. But in order to keep the thing going and to keep the values where they are, we just have to maintain those kinds of of personal disciplines in our thinking.
So. I want to go back to something you said in the shift from level 4 to 5 with you, for you in Hawaii, where you began to be burdened about a place, about a geography, and not just growing a church. How much of that shifting to a geocentric kind of thinking from a church-centric kind of thinking impact the move to level 5 and
it, kind of your hugely journey. Impacted the move from to level 5. Like I said, we already in at least in one of the streams through the church called Branch of Hope, which by the way 34 or 44 years later still exists. They're going real strong, but they were already multiplying and we just didn't get it. So as soon as we started,
so you actually launched a level 5 church without even without even intending to
we never intended,
but then learn from
we never intended to launch it in the first place, and it was our first one, and it became the level 5 church, and we didn't learn from it. We were stupid. I was stupid. It wasn't until we went to Hawaii and we realized that we have to think different, and we weren't thinking in this terminology. And we had no role models to follow. So it was just that everything had to do with leverage and Matthew 28. And so we're to make disciples of all nations. One of the things that we did when we started in Hawaii, we didn't do this before. In Hawaii, we started to press everybody because we felt called to Japan. Japan, other than Saudi Arabia, is the worst place in the world for the gospel. And we have about 40 works in Japan. A lot of them are house churches.
Wow.
And so we've had a lot of success. So we felt called to Japan. We started to school our guys that you need to pray that God will lead you to a country. And how he'll probably do that is lead you to an individual who's got cousins who are contacts in that country. Because at first we thought, we'll look for individuals and we'll send them back.
Yeah.
Well, if they came to America, they don't want to go back. But they got relatives there that they care about. And so we've got churches in Cambodia, Thailand, the Philippines, Japan for sure. We've got a guy working in China, real strong work in China, very underground. So there's a lot that's going on, and a lot of this comes from churches of maybe 100 people where the pastor once a year goes to the Philippines, and they've started 3 churches in the Philippines and villages, whatever.
Yeah.
And our church right now is, like I said, about 300 people. Our guys went down to Kenya, which I thought was absolutely stupid. This is while I was in the second church, the one in Kaneohe, Hawaii. And some of our people wanted to build a greenhouse for an orphanage. And I thought, let somebody from the East Coast do that. We live halfway around the world from Kenya. And they went down there, and now we do eyeglass clinics. So this year we're looking for 3,000 pairs of eyeglasses. We got 3 eye doctors. But the cool thing is that lay people from our church, I hate that term, but it works. Lay people from our church have taught this one pastor.
Non-paid staff, maybe.
Yeah, non-paid staff. That's a good way of saying it. Who pay their own way to Kenya. Yeah. They've taught this pastor how to do mini church and how to use mini church as a tool for training pastors. And now they start 4 more churches in Kenya over a 3-year period of time. And so one of the guys came to me recently. He started 3 in succession. It's really weird. He started with a teenage gang and then a second teenage gang after those guys all graduated high school or grew up and got away, and then a group of straight kids. Both times with the gangs, they were attacked by rival gangs during church, and people went to the hospital. So, and this guy's bivocational, so it was a pretty tough deal that he did. He's in his mid-50s. He just came to me asking would it be all right if he went to Kenya 6 months opposite of the team. So he goes with the team in October. He wants to go in May and just work with the pastors. And so we'll give him our blessing, and we'll probably end up paying for it. We don't want him to pay for this. He pays in October, we'll pay for the other thing. So it's just kind of a spontaneous thing. This is really important to me, this part. As we got started, because we were in a denomination, they retained control. If we started outside of our immediate area, they wanted control. And so we were starting across the United States, and we had to surrender control. Well, then, when I was going to move to Hawaii, we put it in these terms that the Pope has left the Vatican. And the question was, should we headquarter it in Hawaii, or should we headquarter it in California? And we decided to headquarter it in Hawaii, but we didn't. We just kind of did nothing. We maintained the best contact we could with people just through relationships. Then later on, the denomination that I was a part of gave us a budget, and so we could run a conference for the local thing. But we invited the other Hope Chapels to come to it, or the whatever they call themselves. And so one year we had maybe 150 pastors. We're up to 2,200. Because of this conference, I went out and started emailing people. I spent 3 months, because I thought there were 1,400 churches. That's what I used to tell everybody. And I started getting scared. I'm going to go to Exponential, and they're going to find out that I'm a liar and an idiot. And so I did this survey, and actually the numbers are still coming in. As after we published the completed survey, all the guys who were lazy wrote emails, well, we started this many churches, include that in the survey. But the last official count was 2,317 churches have been planted. The most I've ever pastored is 2,200 people, twice.
Wow.
And so there's more than one church per person in any church that I've ever pastored.
And those 2,300 are embedded with the DNA to continue to plant.
Well, not all of them. Some of them have closed. Some of them have planted only their own church. And that's the tragedy. That's the failure. The very thing you're wrestling with, we're wrestling with. We've been successful because we have a lot, but the problem is, it's a good problem, is every so often you get a guy who rips out with 300 churches or 400 churches. And the average guy that's going to plant multiple churches is going to do 4 or 5 and then kind of run out of gas. We don't think that that's justifiable. We think we need to change that, but that's kind of what happened. But we think that our lack of control is actually a benefit to us. One guy who's pastoring 40 Moonies, ex-Moonies, in Sapporo, Japan, it was an executive with a big Japanese corporation, was bivocational for a while, but he knows how to speak their lingo. And so he gets Japanese companies to donate money to dig wells or buy water trucks in India. He goes down there. I mean, if we were controlling the model, this could never happen. I don't even believe in what he does. He hires existing pastors to ride circuit on 3 villages. And everywhere he digs a well or buys a water truck, they start a church. And then he pays a pastor. And I don't even believe in that. But I believe in him, and I'm thankful that he's doing it. We got another guy that started a couple hundred churches in the Philippines and 50 in Uganda. And he does it with Bible schools. And we don't do Bible schools. So it's just the our weakness has actually turned out to be our strength.
It was a small group strategy that led to mini church, and you used the phrase mini church, but they also use the phrase house church when you're talking about some of the churches in Southeast Asia. Do you use all those terms interchangeably, or are you intentional about
them? We are intentional about the word mini church, which is our version of small group, because it's our DNA and the way we do it. To us, house church is what people are calling simple church. And we've done them in garages. We've done them in lots of places. But house church is a word that works. But to us, that's a freestanding church that happens to meet in a house.
Okay.
We know that Rick Warren started in a living room. And so we're not caught up in the house church thing. We just want to use the house to start. But if it stays in the house forever, we're happy. If it grows beyond the house, we're happy about that too. But that's a distinctive to us.
So the house church would satisfy some sort of ecclesial minimum to actually be a church, where mini church would still have a connection to a larger gathering.
Okay. Yeah, and so the house church usually has mini churches. In a situation like Japan, where everything is necessarily small. If a house church has 12 people, they may have three mini churches that meet by Skype because it's so difficult. You know, you could live 5 miles apart, but you got to travel 35 miles on the train to get to each other in Japan. So we do Skype mini churches with Skype video, so they can only have 5 people in them. But it works. We had one church of about 180 people that had over a dozen Skype mini churches. In fact, I think they had 18 Skype mini churches going for one at one time. So it's kind of, you know, we just kind of have had this attitude of just do anything and, you know, look for what works and make it go. So we're more pragmatic than we are strategic. We're more value driven than we are strategy driven. We have a couple of our leading lights in our church right now that are really good strategic thinkers. And there's always a tension between me and them. And I value what they bring to me because they obviously supplement my weakness, but I frustrate the life out of them because I just run counter to their thinking.
You mentioned value-driven. If you were to say these are our top three values, are there three that you look at and say these are the top three? It's not that we don't value, that we don't have other values, but these are the top.
Well, the top one has to be that love is paramount, loving the Lord and loving your neighbor. Which to me, just let me go to meddling a little bit here. I just don't get this whole thing about transgender bathrooms. To me, we got to get around to loving these people. We've had great success with homosexuals getting saved and actually getting married to a heterosexual person. I mean, I just don't understand why we just can't get over this. So love is number one. Number two is making disciples, and number three is planting churches. Those are the things that drive us. And so when we started our church in Honolulu, where I pastor now, which I was 67 when I started, it would make financial sense for me to retire now. It makes emotional sense and spiritual sense for me to keep going. I'm having fun.
Yeah.
When we started, we stated that we are not going to search for a building. We actually did a building search. And there's nothing that we could afford. And we're actually a pretty rich congregation. We're bifurcated. We have a lot of baby boomers and a lot of millennials and not many Gen Xs. So we got a lot of money and a lot of potential. And if we can wed the two together successfully, we're going places. But we told everybody that the city of Honolulu is our campus. We use this hotel for these kind of meetings. We use this library for these meetings. We've rented what used to be an office space that we call the loft as a midweek classroom. We meet in a movie theater on Sunday morning. And if they ever remodel, we're going to be desperate. If they shut down for 6 months, we'll probably have to rent a public school or something.
Yeah.
One thing that I would add to that is in a sense, the model that we've used in Hawaii is broken. We have depended on public schools. When we first went there, it was illegal to use a public school. And we fought and won. And so we started churches. There's another church planting movement in Hawaii. A guy named Wayne Cordero has started a bunch of churches. They got real heavy into the extension campus thing. But then they've used it as a model now for planting churches. That wasn't his original intent, but that's where he is now. So I have great respect for Wayne. There was an atheist guy who attacked what Wayne was doing, sued him in court, and actually won. Made it harder to use schools. But because we had started churches and schools, and Wayne had, and the Calvary Chapels got involved doing the same, and then we have a host of little, mostly Pentecostal churches with strange-sounding names that just filled the schools. Some schools have three churches. We're at the saturation point where it broke the model. There's no more schools to start churches in. So what do you do next? So we're looking real hard at the idea of a bivocational pastor in what we call a house church as the future if we want to saturate the islands with the gospel. This is interesting. We commissioned a study. There's a First Press of Honolulu. They do a thing called HIM Conference every year. And so we gathered a bunch of churches together, and we spent about $60,000. George Barna did a study of how many people call themselves Christians and how many people attend church regularly. When I moved there in 1983, 4% of the people had answered the state census that they were Christians, including Jehovah's Witnesses and Mormons. Catholic Church has been telling everybody 22%. George Barna says 39% attend church at least three times a month. That's huge. And he says over 60% claim to be some kind of Christian. I'm not so sure I totally believe those numbers from what I see, but we've seen great progress, and I would have to say that that progress all comes from people somehow gathering a vision to multiply the church, and that the key to everything isn't bigger churches. I have no interest in my church growing. In fact, we had a board meeting on Sunday before I flew here, and that was one of the things that came up, was one guy worried about we're not growing. We got to grow faster. And we actually are growing a little. And we grew pretty fast at the beginning, but it's tapered off. But we're growing. Our finances are growing. And one of the guys said, hey, we're not a mega church, and we don't want to be a mega church. We're not a house church movement. We don't really want to be that. We may use that. We're pretty good at mid-sized churches and reproducing them, and that's what we're going to be all about. So let's just not even talk about growth here. Let's just talk about it. So the whole addition thing is always there, and you've got to deal with it, but it never has become priority for us.
Yeah.
And going back to the very beginning, we kind of skipped level three by going from level two to level four. And then once you get some kind of momentum and you're planting churches and there gets to be an excitement, well, then the level three thing kind of happens to you rather than pursuing it as a goal.
Right. If you think back to the beginning, to today, if that were a book, a novel or something, what would you say would be the chapters? What would be the chapters in that book from when you began to where you are today?
It's interesting because I actually wrote a book called Let Go of the Ring.
Okay.
When I was getting ready to move to Hawaii, my dentist, who was a Christian, said, you'll never do it, Frodo. They never let go. You'll never let go of the ring. And this is before the movies came out.
From the book.
Yeah, in the 70s. I mean, if you're a card-carrying hippie, you got to have read Tolkien. So everybody knew Tolkien. So I wrote a book about the history of the thing. But I would really put the chapters, and I would include my life. So chapter one would be the development years in a denomination in a Bible college where Mr. Straitlace played by the book. Then came the kind of hippie years of the church in Manhattan Beach, California, which moved to Hermosa. And those very quickly became the reproducing years. And then the years in Hawaii, which were the multiplication years. And I think, though I'm in a different church now, I'm still an extension of what was going on in Kaneohe, so we're still in the multiplication years. I'm actually trying to rewrite that book. And if anybody's listening to this and they're interested, you can still get it used on Amazon, because that's where I get mine. It's out of print, and that's where I get mine.
What I wanted to ask you is if... I do think, as I've traveled around, as I've talked to pastors, the different things that I've been involved in through Exponential and just working with churches in my area, trying to get them to think geocentric, I do think that God is talking to some level three pastors that have been successful and are saying, man, there's got to be more to this. If you had a room full of level three pastors.
I would run the other way.
And the door's locked, so you can't get out. And they're going to listen to you. These are guys there's an angst. There's an angst there. They're not just defending, what they're doing. There's an angst, but they don't know where to go. What would you say to them?
So I have an answer that I've used with the guys who didn't have the angst and not very successfully. But I think with guys who do feel this need is by multiplying, you can afford to die or retire. Because otherwise, as old as I am, I watched 1956 was the peak year of church growth in America until the Jesus movement hit, which was in the early 70s, late 60s. I grew up in the 6th and 7th grade hearing stories about what a great man that was. When he died, no one could fill his shoes. And I think that we're facing that again, especially with the extension campuses. Because if you have extension services in five states with you on video, the possibilities of there being, say, your church plus five others, where a guy can step in and do it as well as you did. Because, I mean, hats off to the guys that are the big level three guys, because they're supermen. I could never do what they did. If I had tried, I would have never pastored any more people. If we had never multiplied a church, I would have never pastored any more people than I pastored. Because always the thing that holds back church growth is the leader, the capacity of the leader. So I would tell people, you could relax a little if you multiply churches, because you can be assured that, and I'm not into legacy talk, but there is some kind of a legacy that after I die, if my church is in a very risky situation, we have no building and we're not saving to build one. So we did that on purpose, just to press our people with where we're going. We'll probably have a building someday, but that's not our issue. But we've put ourselves in jeopardy, knowing that if our church died tomorrow, it would still survive. They would go to other churches. There would probably be a few more churches started out of small groups, and out of the mini churches would band together. When I say small groups, I don't mean equal to mini church. I mean three or four mini churches would make a new church, and they would just know what to do instinctively because we've taught them. So that would be my take to level three guys that were interested. It really makes life easier for you.
Okay, so that room full of level three guys that felt the angst, now they've, half of them have returned the second day and said, okay, I want to multiply, not just die. Right. Are there some specific things that you would say to them? Here's now what you need to be doing.
I would say build a training system that is built around your sermon, because One of the problems that people have with small groups anyway is that they're going to get into weird doctrine. But if you build it around your teaching, they can't get too weird. But build it with an expectation of maturity and growth in the leader, to where he is going to become more of a leader than he was, ultimately knowing that some would become pastors. And try to build that DNA into the whole congregation. That's a hard thing to quantify, but it's not a hard thing to envision, or for anybody to go, well, this is how I do that, my situation.
Yeah. The issue isn't, are we called into ministry now? The issue is what ministry has God called you
to.
That's
right.
And some is to vocational ministry, which is great, which is part of equipping the rest of us to be involved in the ministry that we're at.
I was in China with an architect, a friend of mine, who is the guy I trust the most as a preacher when I'm gone. If I'm going to be gone for 3 weeks, he preaches. And he's running a large architectural firm. He's 54 years old, so he can keep the old guys happy. At the same time, he works well with young people. He's discipling some young guys. We were in China with a bunch of house church leaders. There's 17 of them in this one group. They're not denominationally related. The smallest church, house church, get you, is 4,000 plus members. And the largest is like 15,000. And they meet in these incredible marble edifices. Yeah. And the government is right now cracking down on them. They've actually torn down some buildings. I was there 2 years ago, and it's gotten real rough. So one of our guys is mentoring these guys. While we were there, they were complaining to me, because I was the hot shot, right? If you fly far, you're important. They're complaining that we are self-taught businessmen, because every one of them is a mega millionaire. So guys running multinational electronics firms and pastoring big churches. And they're whining, we didn't go to seminary, and we had to teach ourselves business. We're not really capable of pastoring these churches. So I'm going, you're doing way more than I've ever done. You know, tell me you're not capable. And then the next thing out of my mouth was, Ron here could do what you're doing. And so since then, I've gone to Ron and asked him to pray about becoming my successor, because I'm getting old. He's got it in him. So we're thinking in these terms of that bivocational doesn't mean that you drive a taxi cab. One of our most successful pastors was a medical doctor who was on faculty at UCLA for a while and pastored a church, and actually started it and grew it to 1,000 people And then when we got a full-time pastor, because it kind of swallowed him up and he had to choose, he chose medicine. But when they got a full-time pastor, that guy shrunk it to 500, and it's still a very healthy church that is multiplying churches.
Yeah.
But this whole idea of the bivocational pastor is something. And so Todd's book seems like it'll feed right into where I'm at.
It'll feed right into that. And this is where, I mean, I love every expression of the church. I mean, God does amazing things in level one church through level five. So it's not, it's not about that, but it is about moving so that we can reach gospel saturation in areas. And I think that a big part of that is really, truly releasing the priesthood of believers. And how do we do
absolutely.
That? Like I said, I love all expressions of the church. In 2 weeks, I'll be in San Francisco with 16 of the best multi-site churches and understanding how does multi-site, what's the role multi-site plays in a multiplication strategy. And the average size church of those is 8,000.
Wow.
But my personal network, I'm part of a network of micro churches. Uh-huh. We call them micro churches because we do see them as ecclesial minimum, about 140 micro churches in the Tampa Bay area.
Wow.
And I'll have a meeting Friday night with a guy who feels called to start a ministry with paddleboarders and a guy that feels called to start a ministry in a laundromat. Guy that is working advocacy against sex trafficking and some of, as I've met with some of these people, they're the traditional paradigm, the guy that wants to start the ministry of the paddleboards is like, well, I'm not a pastor. I'm not, but he's feeling this. And the church that he goes to has tried to rein it in. Well, can you get those guys to come here? Or can you do it on another day other than Sunday? And he's like, no, they won't come here. And Sunday is when they meet. And it's just affirming their call that, no, you actually are a pastor. And God's giving you this calling. Now, how do we work this out in the flow of your life and for your family and that sort of thing? But,
that's very exciting for me to hear. We've done a little of that. Among the churches that we count as churches, some of them are micro churches, and some of them are groups of surfers. Some of them are homeless people that meet in a park on Sunday, and that's church. Some of them meet on Tuesday nights, whatever. I think that what you're talking about is the future of the church. I've always thought if I was able to earn an honest living, I'd go try to start a string of what we call house churches. And one day, maybe, I'll be a retired guy doing that. I'm looking forward to those thoughts.
Well, you said you read Acts every day. Did you ever see retirement anywhere? Do you remember seeing that word?
No, I don't see that word anywhere. Okay. And I'm frustrated because, one of my best friends was ragging on me the other day about you need to choose a successor and all that. I'm 70. I just started working out in a gym. I've lost a bunch of weight and feeling better than I have in years. To my mind, my way of thinking, the time that I need to pull the plug is when the 20-year-olds stop coming or when they start to fade away. Somebody else needs to step in. But then at that point, and I do want to start something in a house with old people.
So it's not it's not retiring. It's transitioning to another ministry. This has been wonderful.
It's exciting for me.
Yeah, this is every generation shapes the church for the generation to come.
Yeah.
I think, though, we're in a more malleable time, more of a hinge point than maybe any other time in the history of the U.S. church. I appreciate the example that you've given us because I think the example that you've given us, the freedom of the guys at level three who that's been their model, to be able to challenge and recognize the angst that they're feeling and lean into multiplication. I think that's powerful. That's huge. Man, what a pleasure to meet you. Great to have you here.
It's good to be here.
Yeah, and look forward to having you part of additional conversations that we're going to be having about what multiplication looks like.